It's the Burt Cohen Show. And how much of that dream has to do with keeping us secure from terrorists and actually making war? How heavily is the war machine, the addiction we seem to have to conducting foreign policy through, the barrel of a gun, let's face it, how important is that to what America is? And how important is the war in Afghanistan? What happens when and if we completely pull out? President Obama has just recently announced the withdrawal of 33,000 troops from Afghanistan over the next year, leaving still quite a few in there. And it's unclear what this really means militarily, what it means politically for the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, and what it means for, well, the election of 2012, which is certainly underway. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Newsweek Daily Beast special correspondent Michael Tomasky. He's also editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. Well, Senator John Kerry argues that President Obama did it right, that we are doing this from a position of strength. Is that accurate? And how important is it to start to withdraw troops from a position of strength, Michael?
Well, I think the withdrawal decision is partly military and partly, of course, political. It should be noted for anybody who thinks that Obama broke some kind of campaign promise. I mean, he didn't. He promised when he was running in 2008 that he was going to continue that war and augment that war, and that's what he did.
Yes.
But then he also promised that he was going to start to wind it down before 2012. So that's what he's. That's what he's trying to do here. Position of strength, that can certainly be debated and is debated every day here in Washington. I guess the consensus is that it's a position of greater strength than existed a few months ago insofar as the Taliban, and I don't mean just bin Laden's murder, I mean the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Right.
Have been routed, apparently, in the last few months, fairly successfully everywhere but in the eastern provinces.
So your intelligence comes through that it has been as a result, at least in part, of the surge and just within the past few months. That's an interesting angle there.
Well, that's what the military people say. I'm not a military expert. You know, that's what they say. And that's what the White House says. Now, you know, the interesting thing about this decision and the new policy that Obama announced last week, Bert, is that the extent to which it makes the military unhappy mm-hmm. has to do with the fact that it's not going to apply the counterinsurgency techniques that have apparently worked in the southern provinces to the eastern provinces, where the Taliban still runs pretty free. It's going to apply what they call a counterterrorism strategy, not a counterinsurgency strategy, which is more restricted. And just like they sound, you know, counterinsurgency means go after the insurgents aggressively. Counterterrorism means just stop discrete acts.
Well, I think one could say, and I'd certainly like your reaction to this, that if the reason the U.S. has been in Afghanistan was in reaction to 9/11, was as a measure to fight terrorism, not necessarily to stop a domestic political insurgency, then might it not be said, as Senator George Aiken of Vermont so famously said in 1966 or 7, I believe it was, declare we won and get out. Is that not possible now that the terrorism from the Taliban areas, from the parts of Afghanistan that are controlled by the Taliban, there's not a lot of al-Qaeda there?
No, there's apparently not. And, you know, Aiken's truism might be applicable today. My sense is that the president thinks, and the people in the White House, not all the people in the White House, obviously Joe Biden felt differently, some others felt differently, but certainly Obama himself thinks, and this is a burden, one might say, that is probably unique to the person who sits in the Oval Office. But that concern is making sure, the main concern at this point, to me, as far as he's concerned about this war, is making sure that the Taliban don't march into Kabul again and take over that country. Because if that happens, then you've lost the war. Then you're a president who's lost a war. That's what the press is going to say. That's what the Republicans are going to say. And no president wants to be the president who lost a war.
I feel like I've heard that before somewhere from Lyndon Johnson. He was not going to be the first.
Right.
And we are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Newsweek, Daily Beast, special correspondent Michael Tomasky. That's really not that hard to say. About, well, the politics of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And, you know, there's been a lot of comparisons, really, to Vietnam, of course, when we first dug into this back under, Jimmy Carter, for that matter. Part of the goal, it seems, was to drag the Soviets into the quagmire of Afghanistan and make it their Vietnam that would drain their resources. And you've done some research into this. And, you know, I wonder how much of the Vietnam analogy there may be the case. I mean, I remember when President Nixon, from also a position of strength, as it were, as he said anyway, had Vietnamization, where you wouldn't have American boys, as Johnson said, fighting an Asian war. You'd have the local boys fighting the war. I wonder how similar this drawdown may be. It sounds kind of similar. And I wonder, as you said, the concern about the Taliban marching into Kabul, I get the sense, like in Vietnam, that there was, you know, in Saigon, there was a government, sort of, that seemed to be in place in Saigon. But the rest of the countryside, including what was then South Vietnam, was really no man's land. It could be anybody's territory. And I there was no real South Vietnamese government that I could see. It was, you know, just a bunch of corrupt puppets from America. How similar is that to Afghanistan? Is Karzai really a president of all of Afghanistan? Or is it just Kabul, that the image of Taliban marching into Kabul, that would be the political concern?
I really think it's mostly just the latter. I mean, most Americans don't care very much, to be honest, about what kind of government Afghanistan has, how efficient it is, how corrupt it is, how democratic it is. Most Americans don't care about that. There are similarities between Afghanistan and Vietnam, but I would say the difference is, obviously that a pretty large terrorist attack on United States soil was planned and executed from Afghanistan.
Right.
And that wasn't something that you could say about Vietnam in those days, obviously. So the domino theory had its adherents among the hardliners, but that turned out not to be true. And even if it was true to some extent, it didn't really affect United States national security in any direct way. Recent history shows us that the question of who ran the government in Afghanistan did, in fact, it can't be denied, and I'm not a real hawk or anything like that, but it can't be denied. Who ran Afghanistan actually did have a pretty direct impact on the security of the United States. So that's something that a president is always going to have foremost in his mind.
That's true. That is one very, very big difference. We were attacked by them.
Yeah. Right.
So,
right.
Which obviously was not the case in Vietnam. Of course, Cassius Clay, who later became Muhammad Ali, famously said, no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word. Which,
right.
But right. In this case, we were attacked. So, Michael, do you think in terms of, I suppose, geopolitical strategy, were there better options? I mean, this is 2020 hindsight that George W. Bush may have had after the attacks of 9/11. Or was it strategically, now looking back on where we are in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the world in general, was it the right thing to do for the U.S. to go in there and to rout out the Taliban, which had indeed supported al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I do think it was the right thing to do, and I was not a supporter of Bush by any stretch of the imagination, and I certainly wasn't a supporter of the Iraq War, but I do think the Afghanistan war was the right thing to do. We, you know, as you just said, we were attacked. You have to respond to an attack. Any country would respond to an attack, and I know it wasn't, strictly speaking, the Taliban government that did it, but they were the sponsors of the people who planned it. Yeah, I think we were completely justified to go into Afghanistan. The mistake Bush made, and the thing for which he should really not be forgiven, in my view, is that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld et al., Wolfowitz, knew from very quickly after September 11th that they wanted to use it as an excuse to go in and finish what they considered the unfinished job from 1991 in Iraq and go get Saddam. And so that's what they did. I believe, a lot of people believe, they held back forces from Afghanistan because they knew they wanted to send a much bigger force into Iraq, which indeed they did. The original troop commitment in Afghanistan was, I think, 12,000. It was something very close to that. And the original troop commitment in Iraq, of course, was 140,000. so far bigger. So I think they stinted on Afghanistan so they could go have their war in Iraq. And if that hadn't happened from the start, this might not have lasted a decade.
We are talking with Michael Tomosky about Obama's decision to start withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. And I noticed that a lot of the military commanders disagree with the president on this. And we've had such situations before. We have the military thinking one thing and the civilian president, the commander in chief, who thinks something else and, in fact, is commander-in-chief and is doing that. So how do you think, given that, okay, we had to go in and root out those who attacked us after 9/11, and there has been a lot of American interest in Afghanistan for quite some time, Jimmy Carter before the Soviet invasion, President Reagan was involved, Bill Clinton had his interest in it. How, in comparison to the others, do you think Obama has done when it comes to whatever American interests may be, what the goals of our going into Afghanistan was? How do you think the election of 2012 will look at him in history is at Obama's role and actions in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, Bert, it's sort of hard to say. You know, of course, you start with the notion that Obama was handed this, that he didn't start this, that he didn't ask for this. But, you know, I think that he has, as he does with a lot of things, as he does with a lot of things on domestic policy, as I think he's doing right now on domestic policy with regard to these debt ceiling negotiations, he plays his cards too close to his vest. Yeah. He doesn't state a public position early and loudly. He doesn't draw lines in the sand. He's pretty flexible, some maybe too flexible. And so as a result, I think in Afghanistan, there was, in a lot of people's minds, question about what the mission was. You know, was the mission routing the Taliban? Was the mission establishing a democracy and helping to build a nation, you know, nation building, as
right.
people say?
Right.
I think there wasn't complete clarity on that all the time. Only events will tell. You know, if we get out, if we're out by 2014, which I think actually is probably not exactly going to happen, but mm-hmm. but let's say Obama gets reelected, and for sake of argument, and let's say that we do largely get out sometime during his second term, I think if, as long as the country doesn't go back into Taliban hands, I think he will at least have gotten a draw from history out of it, and maybe even a lowercase W win.
Could be so, whatever the heck a win is, and I guess that's
yeah,
hard to define, because it's this anti-terrorist versus fighting against the insurrection, and I believe it was General Petraeus, perhaps some other military authority, who, when asked why we haven't won after all these years, said basically it's their country. And
yeah.
In Vietnam, we did not win the hearts and minds. And I wonder how, you know, in terms of what looks like a victory, you know, what our goals would be. You know, there's the Taliban, which had, I guess, given a platform for al-Qaeda. Now, you have said that defeat would mean a Taliban back in control and able again to sponsor terrorism on a grand scale. That would not be acceptable, certainly, I think, to...
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you very well right now.
Well, you said defeat would mean a Taliban back in control and able again to sponsor terrorism on a grand scale, and I don't think we can accept that. But what if al-Qaeda is not in power? If some, you know, we are negotiating with the Taliban, I understand. What if they're in power and we don't have a Karzai, we don't have a real, you know, puppet government as we did in Vietnam? Then so what? I mean, can't we live with a Taliban, with the Afghanis, say they choose to go the Taliban way, as long as they're not sponsoring al-Qaeda, which I think, hopefully, our intelligence forces can gather that information? Then, Michael, so what if that's what they choose?
Well, you know, this is, yeah, but the question here also is realpolitik versus, you know, whether we have some higher aspirations for our foreign policy. And, you know, that's a very difficult question. Realism, realpolitik would dictate that, yes, we can live with that. And as long as they're not getting in our hair, we don't really care that much, and we can't really tell them what kind of government to have, et cetera, et cetera. You and I'm sure your listeners know all those arguments. The other arguments would say, well, really? We can live with that? We, the United States of America, can live again with, you know, women wearing burqas and being stoned in soccer stadiums and not getting to go to schools and things like that, which I'm saying I presumably might be effects of Taliban getting back into power, because those were policies of the Taliban in the 1990s. Really, we want to live with that? I don't really want to live with that. But then the question is, what political will do we have collectively in the United States to put money and other instruments of our power behind changing that? And I would suspect that at this point, after this war, most Americans are just going to say, leave them to their own fate. I'm not sure that makes me very happy, but that's probably the case.
Well, there may be, and I'm getting the sense that there's an alternative vision for Afghanistan than going back to the, you know, extreme religious fanaticism and, as you say, stoning of people, things like that, that perhaps an alternative may be kind of something new. And you have said that, quote, what's happening in Afghanistan and across the region is the beginning of a transformation toward freedom that will probably take at least two generations. Do you think, is this resonating with the people there? And I wonder if you could just kind of explain more about why you believe that to be the case.
Afghanistan is not the best example of that. Obviously, Tunisia and Egypt are the best examples of that. But
good point.
But yeah, I think we've seen that there clearly are forces within Afghan society that want to become a democratic republic and want their nation to be a more open society. And obviously, in, as I mentioned, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, there's an awakening, obviously, going on in that part of the world embedded by technology that is very encouraging at first blush, but we can't possibly know at this point how things are going to turn out. I mean, in Egypt, for example, we have elections coming up in September. Those are going to be extremely pivotal. Often revolutions like that one, which were just a little bit inchoate and just about getting a strong man out of power, are followed by a second phase where somebody, where everything's kind of up in the air, and somebody steps in and says, "Okay, now we're the ones in power." And often those aren't such great people.
Indeed,
but
we have seen that a few times. Well,
yeah,
just to say, you know, assume that we do see an Afghanistan that is transforming, that, you know, there are schools being built, and Greg Mortensen has, for all his faults, talked about that quite a bit, about the importance of building schools, about building alternatives to the madrasas that you know, breed hatred and terrorism. I wonder what, Michael, your sense, and you've done a lot of research into this, would be an appropriate role for the U.S. in this process. What's our role in terms of aid, but also our military role? Obviously, it's been very much military, and a lot of people, especially in the anti-war side, have said, look, there is no military solution. We have to, you know, help them with their economy, get perhaps off the opium cultivation dependence, and to help their economy, their battered, you know, awful economies, which has been that way for probably centuries, help them with that. So what is the role for the U.S., do you think, in this transformation process, and the role of the military, if you could?
I would agree that it's not very military. It shouldn't be very military. It should be diplomatic and economic in nature. We do some of that now. You know, we're the United States is financing the building of schools and sewage systems and so forth in parts of Afghanistan. So, you know, we do some of it, but I think we don't do enough of it. Unfortunately, my view is pretty much a minority one.
Join the club.
And as you know very well, Bert, the foreign aid budget of the United States is about 1% of the overall budget, maybe even a little bit less than 1%. And you ask people in polls, and they think it's 20%, and they say, giving our money to those foreigners, and then so on and so forth. And so there's no way even to explain to people that foreign aid only takes 1% of the budget. They just wouldn't even believe it.
I know. It's one of those things that perception becomes reality.
Yeah.
And it's a rather difficult thing we have to work with here in American politics. You're listening to The Bert Cohen Show. Our guest today is Michael Tomosky, editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas, which is most interesting, and also special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Well, there's the gorilla out there that we haven't mentioned yet, the 800-pound gorilla, Pakistan. What is Afghanistan just a pawn in this power game between U.S. and Pakistan and the Shiite powers, the Irans that, you know, are not exactly our friends? The relationship between Pakistan, which obviously was somehow, you know, hiding bin Laden. Somebody there was hiding bin Laden in their territory. The relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan and the U.S. have deteriorated sharply, especially since, you know, we came into this sovereign nation and did something which certainly could be described as illegal, just going into some sovereign nation and assassinating a few people. What can the role of Pakistan be now, and how, you know, Pakistan appears to be a bit more destabilized in recent days, and they, as we all know, have nuclear weapons. How might there's a lot of questions about Pakistan. Their biggest rivalry, of course, is with India, and we never hear much about that. So what do you know about Pakistan coming out of all this as we see our troops starting to be pulled out of neighboring Afghanistan?
Well, it's a really complicated situation. I'm glad you mentioned India, because that's really, I think, what Pakistan cares about at the end of the day, and whether the United States is being pretty, you know, more or less a neutral judge or neutral player in its competition with India. That's something that the United States will have to turn its attention to, I think, at some point in the pretty near future, that relationship. You know, we've all known for a long time that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, was pretty corrupt or had pretty corrupt elements, and it seems, you know, it's impossible to believe that Osama bin Laden could have been living where he was without that corruption being true. I think that will eventually blow over. The problems in Pakistan over what we did with the bin Laden raid, that'll take a little bit of time, but I think it'll blow over. But mm-hmm. but you know, I think Pakistan is just one of those relationships to be managed, and to expect not very much and hope that nothing really terrible happens.
But that is not going to be an easy task for sure. It seems like U.S. policy in Afghanistan has not exactly won us a lot of friends in Pakistan. What's your sense of the hearts and minds of the Pakistanis? Are they, you know, they have been pretty, you know, solid ally, at least the government there has been, of the United States. And I wonder how threatened that is by our role in Afghanistan.
I just think in the long term it's not really that threatened. I think you know, the United States and Pakistan have one of those relationships of mutual use. You know, they are mutually useful to each other for certain things.
Uh-huh.
You know, Pakistan is mutually useful to the United States as a kind of a helper in the region on certain sensitive things, even though the ISI might be corrupt and so forth. You know, Pakistan works in concert with the U.S. in certain intelligence functions and so forth. The United States is obviously useful to Pakistan because Pakistan can't alienate the United States and then let the United States tilt too far in India's direction. It doesn't want to do that. It needs the United States to intervene and monitor that relationship. So the two countries serve a function for each other, and I think that's about how that relationship has gone and will go.
Interesting about how important their animosity to India is and making sure they don't want to alienate us to make us tilt more toward India. That's a very stabilizing factor, which they probably are not real crazy about, but that's the way it is. Now,
a lot of international relations is built on such such presumptions.
Oh, absolutely. Playing one off the other. We all know that, going back to the First World War, etc. We are talking with Newsweek, Daily Beast special correspondent Michael Tomosky, who's also editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas, about the announcement recently by Obama of a beginning of a drawdown from troops in Afghanistan. And I have to be careful not to say Vietnam, because, boy, does this sound familiar. You know, position of strength. Nixon talked about peace with honor, whatever that is. And we have elections that are very much underway. I wonder how much of what Obama is doing is with an eye to November of 2012. We have a recent poll from The Hill magazine that 32% of conservatives say that the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan is too slow. 32% of self-identified conservatives. Only 30% of liberals say it's too slow. We have people like Ron Paul and a lot of people in the Republican right, basically, you know, somewhat isolationist, I suppose, saying, let's get the heck out of Afghanistan, say we won, and get out. How, you must have a pretty thorough analysis of how Obama came to this position with regard to the upcoming election. It's got to be some kind of very careful balancing act and strategizing for the campaign.
Yeah, I think it fits a pattern. It relates to what I was saying a few moments ago about when I was talking about the debt ceiling and so forth. It fits a pattern of Obama's, which you know, tends, unfortunately, to keep people on both sides kind of unhappy, which is that he straddles the middle and sits on the fence as much as he can on these things. And there is something in him that leads him to think that is the prudent course. And, you know, a lot of times it might be the prudent course, but you know, it tends not to make either his partisans or the partisans on the other side very happy. It's odd about the Republicans, but, you know, I think that it's odd because their positions, except for Tim Pawlenty, who's now staking out a more straightforwardly neoconish kind of foreign policy posture. But the other Republicans are running away from that. But I think they're just doing two things. Obviously, they're just reading polls, which show that most people want out of Afghanistan, and they're just being partisan, which is to say, if Obama's for it, I'm against it, right. which is the typical Republican posture on everything.
That's been the case for sure. And I wonder, you know, there's President Obama, who is running for re-election. He's a Democrat. He's the nominee, I think we can assume. And he's also commander-in-chief. So there's a number of factors yanking on him in terms of direction. I wonder how much, I mean, we can't really know this, how the president really feels. Is this being what is truly the right and responsible action to take in Afghanistan? He must see that to a large degree. I mean, it is clearly, you know, down the middle course, you know, leaving a lot of troops in, pulling some troops out. But just, I wonder if his advisors, I don't know what you hear down in D.C. about how much he believes, or maybe Obama doesn't really have any particular belief when it comes to whatever the right thing is, as opposed to the political thing in Afghanistan.
I think he's doing what he thinks is right. I definitely think that. I mean, he's you know, this is a part of how he arrives at his conclusions. This deliberative process, and he hears arguments from his left and arguments from the right, and he sorts through both, and he's resistant by nature, I think, to saying, well, all the arguments of this one side must be correct and all the arguments of this other side must be incorrect. There's something in his nature that just bridles at that, I guess, and so he sort of plots this middle ground. There's obviously some political calculation in the size of the drawdown, and he's obviously got to be thinking about re-election. What person sitting in that office wouldn't be thinking about re-election? However, I guess I'd say that I wouldn't think in his case that's the main thing, and I would also say that, you know, public opinion is a legitimate factor. It's not just a political factor, something to be dismissed as mere politics. You know, public opinion is, in a democracy, is a legitimate factor for a president to take into account.
I would say it's certainly an important thing in a democracy, no doubt about it. So what if, okay, say we, and this is reading the tea leaves a little bit, which I suppose is apropos for Afghanistan. What if, okay, we start to pull out there, and then we don't see stability in Afghanistan. We don't see an Afghanistan capable of charting its own future. So a lot of the people in Afghanistan, I suppose, you know, if they want to, I don't know what their goals would be to destabilize the president, but I wonder how the military people think, is it stable enough? Do you expect to see, after this beginning of the pullout, continued relative stability, or more of a threat to Karzai, who doesn't seem to be that well loved in Afghanistan?
No, to put it mildly. Well, first of all, pull out, we should define this a little bit more precisely.
Okay.
Pull out doesn't mean that nobody's going to be left. Pull out means that there are still going to be many thousands of American soldiers there.
Right. More than when he took office.
Maybe, you know, or at least as many, you know, at least several thousand. Now, they're not going to be forward combat troops is what pull out means. you know, running out, you know, going across the countryside and looking for action. Mm-hmm. They're going to be stationary troops, and they're going to be there to keep an eye on things and keep a lid on things. And I don't think that I don't think the military would permit, or I don't think this president or any president, probably short of, you know, like Dennis Kucinich being in the White House, would permit anything less than that. There's going to be a military presence, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be over there fighting. They're just going to hopefully be there watching.
Aha. Uh-huh. Sounds like Vietnamization, which, and we all know how that turned out. And I know you have to take off, but I just wanted to ask, it sounds like you're seeing our U.S. military and diplomatic helpful presence in Afghanistan continuing for a long time. And that's, you know, saying that's okay is not a voice we hear all that often. I get the sense that you think it's appropriate for us to be there for quite a while, and it will be useful to American interests, and the activist base that got Obama there shouldn't be too upset. I mean, he hasn't changed his position since the 08 campaign. So your feeling is that this may be an okay course to go on.
Yeah, that is my view. Yeah, that's a fair summary of my view. I would hasten to say that I don't think we should be there in a shoot-'em-up capacity for much longer. But the fact of the matter is, there are other ways to be there. There are diplomatic ways, economic development ways. This kind of policing, not engaging in combat role that I'm talking about, but you know, helping to maintain some kind of stability. And there are all those kinds of roles to play. And look, we've been in Afghanistan since 1980. In one form or another, we've been there. That's a long time, and it looks like we're going to stay there. And at this moment in that part of the world, when it does appear that maybe things are shaking loose, and maybe with a lot of luck, there will be some democratic transformations happening in that region. That may, you know, maybe this time actually we'll have a domino theory, Bert. Maybe we'll have a positive domino theory in that part of the world over the next 40 years, if we're lucky. At this point, when we're on the verge of maybe seeing something like that happen, it's not right really for the United States to withdraw into any kind of isolationist posture and say that we don't care. I mean, we do care about what happens to people in developing countries. We should care. We're supposed to care. We're supposed to care about women's rights. We're supposed to care about freedom of speech and assembly and our values, not just for Americans, but for all people.
And it actually, I think, could be convincingly said that that kind of thing, not only is the right thing to do, it's in our economic and security interests. I really believe that. Just, I'll let you get a plug in for Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. I don't know if you want to describe that before you have to take off.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, and I am sorry I have to cut out a little bit early, but I have a couple of things I have to do. But Democracy is a quarterly journal that I edit, and its website is www.democracyjournal.org. And it's an ideas and policy journal that has existed for 5 years. It's a progressive liberal leaning, but big tent in that realm, so that we have, you know, some centrist views and some more liberal views, and we have people sometimes sort of arguing with each other in our pages. And you know, it's serious. 5,000 word articles, 3,000 word articles, no pictures. but I think it's also engaging.
Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. It fascinating concept to have politics about ideas and policies and concepts and not just celebrity.
Right.
Thank you very much, Michael Tomasky, for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show. I look forward to reading more.
Thanks, I enjoyed it.
All right. And we'll be back after some musical break.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Bert Cohen Show, Uzair Humkar of the Afghans for Peace. And I wonder, you know, I certainly voted for Barack Obama as president. We were all hopeful that there would be change. Many of us were very surprised when he chose the option of sending a lot more troops into Afghanistan. And I know that during the war in Vietnam, people in Vietnam certainly hated the occupation, hated the bombings and the terror that was coming down, but they didn't hate the American people. What do Afghans think of American citizens? Do they, you know, any kind of reaction? They must know that most Americans, you know, would never do what's being done to them by our government.
The Afghan people have had a good history with the United States, and that's because the United States was supporting good factions of the freedom fighters who were fighting against the communist invaders in Afghanistan. So many of them saw, you know, America as, you know, a great country, as their allies. Even before that, like my mother, she was in Kandahar, and growing up, she had, you know, European and American teachers. You know, they were there. A lot of them would visit Afghanistan, and, you know, they saw it as a vacation place, a place to relax and whatnot. So they had this history. They acknowledged that the United States, many of the people are there to help them, their allies and whatnot. Again, that was because of the Russian occupation. However, and that was one of the reasons why you had that initial support. When the United States initially came into Afghanistan, some people remembered that. They remembered, okay, the United States was helping us against the communists. Now they're here to liberate us, and that's the sad reality. It doesn't happen. But it depends on the Afghan you ask. I think some Afghans, sure, who don't have an understanding of history or of world politics, many of them may very much hate Americans, because the only experience they have with Americans are these people who are toting guns, who don't speak their language, who, you know, if you look at them, they'll pull you over, they'll interrogate you, they might take you in the night. Many people have a very bad image of Americans in Afghanistan, and we have to change that by, again, working with those people, talking with them, and, you know, winning their hearts and minds. And regarding your point with Obama, you know, it really saddens me to say this, but, you know, me too, I really supported him initially, but as soon as all this was happening and he decided to send those troops, I just realized, I'm sorry to say, you know, Bush's third term, because the defense budget, the military spending has actually increased astronomically.
Yes.
And now we're even in Yemen. If anything, you know, Obama has expanded the wars and has engaged us in another war. And it's really sad for me to say that.
Yeah, it is very sad to see that happening. He gave the impression of being somebody who would see through that and would not be a Lyndon Johnson who let it get out of control, but he seems to be doing that. And speaking of getting out of control, Pakistan, right next to Afghanistan, and what's your sense of what's going on in Pakistan right now? I mean, the U.S. has all these drone attacks killing lots and lots of civilians in Pakistan, and the government seems to be far less stable than it used to be. What is the overlap between the wars in Afghanistan and what seems to be a kind of unofficial but obvious de facto war in Pakistan?
Right. Afghans for Peace shows, you know, great solidarity with the people of Pakistan and in that region who are suffering from these drone attacks. We see them as our brothers and sisters, and we're trying to work with them as well, because we feel, like you said, it's kind of a de facto war. It's an extension of the war, just moved to the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the drone attacks, as you may have mentioned, they kill lots of civilians. I mean, for every drone attack that happens, true, they may kill one so-called Taliban. I don't know what that means. Again, I don't know what the United States defines as Taliban, these people with all these different motives. But they kill a Taliban member, but at the same time, they're killing X number of civilians. And what the United States fails to realize is that when you kill those civilians, their family members are turning into the Taliban. That's what happens. They take arms and they fight back. It's the same situation with Afghanistan in terms of, you know, the psychology of the people who want to take up arms and join the so-called Taliban movement. But in terms of what's going on there, yes, there are legitimate concerns that Afghans have, that there are some factions within Afghanistan that are supporting the Taliban. They're supporting extremists within Afghanistan. Like I said earlier, the United States was funding these schools or madrasas, whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm, which was teaching the people these hateful ideologies in order to use those people to fight against the Russians. They thought those people would be the best soldiers. And Brzezinski acknowledged this, and he said, you know, and someone even brought up to him, "What, don't you think this might have some backlash for the United States in the future? You know, won't the chicken come home to roost?" And he said, "Don't worry about that." He kind of waved that off. unfortunately, that's what happened. You have those groups in Pakistan, and that's a concern. Those groups should, you know, should be addressed. But I think that's the responsibility of the Pakistani government. And this Pakistani government, unfortunately, is not doing that, even though the United States is giving them millions and millions in aid. And I don't think it's the responsibility of the United States to attack a sovereign nation without a declaration of war and, you know, kill those peoples in the hopes of, you know, stopping the Taliban, whoever those people are.
Wow, attacking a sovereign nation without a declaration of war. What a concept. You know, we used to have the Constitution of the United States created, required that a president by him or herself cannot declare war, cannot start a war. But we've done it over and over and over again to our peril. And it seems that a lot of what we're doing is counter to the U.S. interest. We've had a Western favorable government in Pakistan, but that seems to be being destabilized as we speak. Does the opium trade have to be addressed? Is that a big part of the problem? Or what's your sense of the opium trade as a factor in this war?
Yeah, personally, I have mixed feelings regarding the opium. You have some people who claim that the Taliban is benefiting from the opium. However, I would like to point out that if there's one positive thing that came from the Taliban, just one thing that came positive from the Taliban regime, so many things they did were disgusting and atrocious, but one good thing they did with the United Nations did acknowledge was the fact that the amount of opium that was coming out of Afghanistan was at a record low. They almost wiped it out. And that's amazing. Again, I'm not trying to justify Taliban, almost wiped it out. But you have some people who claim that the Taliban is benefiting from the opium right now. They're the ones who are growing the opium, and they're selling it to make money to fight against the United States and NATO. And on the other side, you have people who say, that the United States is there partly because of the opium. And, I wouldn't necessarily, just throw that idea away, because you have the United States with its history of, the the Contra-backed forces in Nicaragua, and you have them, you have the United States supporting their drug, their cocaine trafficking, in the region. So it wouldn't really surprise me that the United States is somehow engaging in this. But who knows? We're not there on the ground level. Sometimes we have these stories of Afghans who say, "Oh yeah, the United States came in, and instead of burning all of the opium, they just took them all in a truck and they drove them away, and now they're giving them to European pharmaceutical companies to make drugs and whatnot." You have a lot of these ideas going on. I personally don't know which one to believe, because there's a huge diversity of thought regarding opium.
I'm sure, but it's been such a part of the economy for so long. I mean, heck, where there's money to be made, and as you said earlier, people have to feed their families. That's, it doesn't matter what country it is. That's the bottom line, really. So, Uzair Humkar, you are with the Afghans for Peace. What can be done? What do you think will be done within the next few years that could build a stable and lasting peace? And do you see any movement in the U.S. Congress to start to question it, both on the left and the right?
So the percentage of Americans who are against this war is increasing, and that's a good sign.
Yes.
People who don't want military engagement. One thing I can really suggest to the American government, to NATO, is simply just the first step is to stop engaging in military activities, stop engaging in bomb attacks and drone strikes, in torture, in night raids. These activities create terrorists. This is where terrorism comes from. Terrorism is not just something that pops up out of nowhere. We have to understand that we shouldn't sympathize with it, and we shouldn't support it. We shouldn't support those who engage in terrorism, but we should at least try to understand where is it coming from. We can't just throw on these things of, oh, well, it's just this Islamic ideology. I mean, that's not going to cut it for me.
Right.
It's much more complex than that. When people feel that they're being threatened, when they have nothing to lose, these people who have no education, these people who have no jobs, they lost their family members, or they know that one of their family members is being tortured, I mean, they have nothing to lose. They're just going to give up their lives and devote their lives to a cause which they see will one day free their nation. And we have to really acknowledge this. Once we acknowledge that, we'll be able to come up with alternatives. And that's, like I said, building schools, building hospitals, building roads, bridges, trying to win the hearts and minds of the people, trying to get legitimacy for the Afghan government, for the people. The people recognize it and are working with the government. So once we do leave, the government will still be intact. And another thing is really trying to tackle the poverty in Afghanistan, yes, and the illiteracy in Afghanistan, trying to get the education level up so that when Taliban members do come up to Afghans, they'll be able to say no. They won't, you know, join them because of economic reasons or ideological reasons or whatnot. I think that there is a growing movement in Congress. I don't see much of it, but I think it's there and it's growing because the United States is sick and tired, the population of the United States, there's a growing faction of the U.S. population who don't want the war, who don't support the war, and I think that's kind of correlated with the economic times. You have many people, sure, in the Tea Party on the right who claim that we have to stop government spending. Well, the first thing you want to do is you should cut, you know, the defense budget. It's $500 trillion at least, and it's been increasing with the Obama administration. Instead of cutting Medicare and health care and everything, just cut the spending that we're giving to the war. And I think if the Congress really presents it in that kind of manner of, okay, well, we can help the economy in one way, and that's by, you know, and this is appeasing the right, obviously. We can help the economy, you know, in one way, and that's stop spending the money on the war and spend it here in the United States and really give back to the people.
Makes an awful lot of common sense. It'll probably therefore never happen. But no, I think the right is amenable to that. And I wanted to thank you so much, Uzair Humkar with Afghans for Peace. What is the website? I'm sure people will be curious to find out about Afghans for Peace.
It's afghansforpeace.org. Or you can also look us up on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or everywhere.
Afghans for Peace. Couldn't be simpler. Afghansforpeace.org, correct?
Yes, correct.
Thank you so much, Uzair Humkar, for being with us today, and good luck with the work that's going on. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
All right, likewise. Email me with your thoughts and comments, bert@bertcohen.com. Thank you very much for listening to The Bert Cohen Show.
I'm living with